I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We explore the cultural and physical development of life in the modern city through the lens of history and the context of community. Today's show, A Conversation with Phil Harrison, brought to you by Perkins & Will and Hirsch Bednar Associates. My guest today is President and CEO of Perkins & Will, Phil Harrison. Our audio adventure in exploring the art, education, and future of architecture covers visual thinking, iconic design versus transparent detail, and the broader role of designers in the social realm. Plus, you get to hear about a personal passion for art and community. I hope you'll enjoy the conversation. Okay, so we're going to start out by just testing our levels.
Right, do I need to be closer?
Or? Yeah, if you can pull the mic just to like where you're about here.
And like that?
Yeah, let's say. Did you walk to work today?
I did not walk to work today.
That's
all
right. I
drove because I had to get here, among other reasons.
But you like walking.
I do like to walk. And I like to ride bikes.
Do you see... Actually, you know what? Let's back up. I know who you are.
Okay.
Let's tell the listener who you are and what you do.
All right. My name is Phil Harrison. I live in Atlanta, and I'm an architect with the firm Perkins & Will. I'm the CEO of the firm. Perkins & Will is a global design firm that has offices in many North American and global cities, and I lead the overall firm, but I live in Atlanta, which is one of our offices. It's not our headquarters, but it's one of the places where we work. I also sometimes get to work on design projects in the area, and that's my background.
Do you see architecture differently when you're walking or biking than otherwise?
Absolutely. I think the idea of speed in life is a really interesting topic to talk about, and there's a great book called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow that you've probably read, which is how you sort of react to things at speed or react to things at a slower pace. And I love to travel on a bike, for example, because you see things differently. You smell, you hear things. Likewise with walking.
I've seen in education a hopeful trend in getting a little bit more outside the classroom.
Yeah, I was just today talking with actually a magazine editor about the idea of active design and that buildings and environments that encourage activity is a new trend. And so we used to think of health related to buildings as something that a occupant was receiving. And you go to a hospital or a clinic for health care. But if designers think about health across all building types and all urban environments, you can create spaces that actually encourage activity. For instance, as you say, in the classroom, you don't have to learn inside of a room that's 20 feet by 30 feet that has desks all pointing in the same direction. You can move into a common space, an experimental lab space, or you can go outside and do things. And there's all kinds of studies that demonstrate that learning happens better when minds are activated through experience.
And when you're working on major projects, national, international projects, big projects at universities and within healthcare systems, are you helping the client to understand that type of thinking, or are they giving you all ideas, or is it a working session together?
I think part of the future of design and for architects and interior designers, graphic designers, urban planners, is to get away from the pro forma-based thinking about the project. You know, when a client says, I want 100,000 square feet and I want it to cost $200 a square foot, you don't just immediately go and design that. One of the new opportunities for designers is to think about reframing the whole problem, in that you're designing a space or an environment that does something, that has certain goals. And the goals may be very specific to the client's need, but they might also be broader goals about the environment, about the city, about the occupants, about the experience. And so defining design problems in those terms is, I think, the responsibility of good designers, and allows you to have a conversation with your client at a much more purposeful level. And so student performance in schools, recovery times in clinics driven by natural daylight, workers' satisfaction in a corporate headquarters because they're not only sitting at their desk, but they're having meaningful interactions with their colleagues around a break area or around an interactive mixing zone. Those kinds of design opportunities very often don't reveal themselves in the program, the classical program. And so architects and interior designers today can recast all these kinds of design problems into qualitative terms, into more purpose-driven terms.
down and packed for traveling. Looking at happiness, keeping my flavor fresh. Nobody knows, I guess, how far I'll go. I know, so I'm leaving at 6 o'clock. Meeting a parking lot, having a head no shot. Sunglasses on, she waits by this glass. From head to toe, except a couple tiny holes and openings where the city's blowing in and out. And this is what it's all about. Delightfully, everything's possible when you're an animal, not inconceivable. Nothing is out of place. Gonna be on my way. Try to pretend it's not only glass and concrete.
You know, we've got competing forces for our time right now. So there's both an acceleration of the pace of life and a high element of distraction in the thing, all the stuff that's thrown at us, you know, through social media or television or advertising or whatever. And it's easy to sort of let that become the world in which you live, just a lot of reactions to stimuli around you. And in that kind of a environment, there's also an opportunity to learn how to listen in a different way and to listen in a broader sense and to take all those stimuli and actually turn them into a new kind of listening that allows you to engage with your environment in a new way. So the downside of a distracted society is you stop doing anything meaningful at all. It's all reactions. The upside is you have a new access to sort of a big data mindset about the world around you and can respond in a more meaningful, purposeful way. It's more of a state of mind, and I'm not talking some sort of Zen Buddhist sort of mindset either. It's more just the discipline to be purposeful and focused and not let the hyper activity of modern life take over the opportunity for meaning.
Are you surprised at all where you are in your career, given that you started with an education and passion in the arts as a painter?
Not really. My undergraduate education was in visual arts and philosophy. You know, it was sort of a hybrid learning, so I did practice as an artist for 3 or 4 years and decided to go to architecture school because I was interested in more integration of multiple inputs of financials, of environmental issues, of people, social issues, along with visual thinking. And I think ultimately that's what architecture is. It's an art that combines and synthesizes a lot of different things. And my education was also in philosophy, which is sort of a broader kind of intellectualizing of a number of different things, experience, thinking, those sorts of things. And so I sort of started with a synthetic education. Architecture is an applied art that can solve broader social problems. And it's quite interesting today that a number of other disciplines and other industries are adopting architectural principles in problem solving. So-called design thinking has become a way of business education, much famously made popular at the Stanford D School, which teaches design thinking to entrepreneurs to solve problems in a more a less linear way and a more integrative way, where you're sort of thinking a lot of different inputs and consolidating them into a single output, whereas business training used to be a very linear progression. So I actually think that it doesn't really matter what you learn. It could be art, it could be business, it could be whatever. So long as you learn synthetic thinking, you can actually approach any kind of problem solving in a similar sort of effective way.
If we take that and we come up with a problem, like lack of public art on Peachtree Street in Atlanta, mm-hmm. are a large part of our identity, Peachtree mm-hmm. Street, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do we solve that? What's the answer? Or an answer?
I think that I'm an optimist, and I believe that cities or networks or systems sort of self-heal or self-cure over time. So Atlanta as a city has a tradition of of sort of a go-fast mentality and look towards progress, which is one of its greatest assets, but also has caused it from a physical artifact standpoint. In other words, the physical city or the things that it leaves behind sometimes are not well cared for as they might be. But I think as people care about the city more and more, as they spend more time in the city, as people move into the downtown area of Atlanta, it will just get cared for more and more. The system will heal itself. So I don't know that we need an external push to change our culture in a sense, because then we might change it for the worse. I think that over time, what makes Atlanta Atlanta will get richer and richer, and as density drives, so there'll be a demand for experience. There'll be a demand for creativity in the city. A lot of the beauty of this city is in the neighborhoods, and remarkably, it's probably the only city that I know of in North America that has such amazing neighborhoods so close to the center of town. You know, Virginia Highlands and Morningside and Anzi Park and Brookwood Hills and Inman Park, Candler Park, West End are right there. And they already, as neighborhoods, have quite a lot of identity, quite a lot of self-organization and motivations, and are sort of taking care of themselves. So there's something to build on already through those neighborhoods. I think, you know, certain places like the Midtown part of downtown, through the Midtown Alliance, already has a very impressive organization to improve streetscapes or public art or those kinds of things we were talking about earlier. Those emerging sort of semi-public organizations are already doing quite a lot. And I don't think you need to wait for the city to do it or for the government, you know, the state to do it or anyone else like that. I think it's happening. And I think it'll naturally happen more and more, as I said before. It'll sort of self-heal as Atlanta becomes a more and more important city, as it grows demographically, as people continue to sort of come in and out of Atlanta. That richness will lead to just a richer place.
We got industry, new municipal, the Cyclorama at Grant. We're a city of a million, home of the eternal land. I recommend it for a lifetime, or just a day. Atlanta, Atlanta, that's my hometown. Atlanta, Atlanta, that's my hometown.
We're speaking with Phil Harrison, President and CEO of Perkins & Will. I've enjoyed on this show, and thank you again for all of y'all's support, talking to some of those individuals who are those thought leaders and who are being innovative within a team like Jeff Stebar, and Keith and Paula and Bruce. I mean, Ryan, a number of them. And everyone I meet at Perkins & Will is a real talent. The firm has a talent for that. And it's fun to be around, to be honest. So,
well, we're trying to make a place where people that have those values, that believe in making the world a better place and believe that design is one of the better ways to make the world a better place, and that transformative design is a powerful thing, and then that the environment needs to be cared for, that innovation and curiosity can make problem solving richer and more powerful. All those things add up to a certain type of people, and those people, it's hard to practice on your own. It's a difficult business. It's much more rewarding to work with like-minded friends and colleagues who want to accomplish the same thing. And so a lot of those people work together to accomplish that. Sometimes they work on their own, but they know they can go back to the office and bounce ideas off their partners and friends. All that leads to a stronger, more resonant, and impactful practice.
I'd like to thank my guest today, President and CEO of Perkins & Will, Phil Harrison. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next month.